welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willems, and this episode's guest, Jane Yolen. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, the podcast where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett. I am myself an author of many books of science fiction and fantasy for readers of all ages. My most recent series is called World Shapers and got its start just at the same time as this podcast back in August of 2018. And it's a story about a woman with the ability to shape the world that she's in, but she doesn't know she has that ability in the first book. She finds out that she's the shaper of that world and that she's made the world to be the way it is. And then she finds out there's a whole lot of shaped worlds. And she's given the quest, if you like, of traveling from world to world and discovering the details of the shaping of those worlds and conveying that knowledge to Ygritte, the mysterious woman at the center of this labyrinth of shaped worlds, in order to save them all from the depredations of the mysterious adversary who is taking them over one by one and seems to be hell-bent on killing Ygritte and destroying the entire labyrinth of shaped worlds. And all these shapers came from our world originally, so all of their worlds are influenced by what they knew in our world. So in the first world, in World Shapers, Shauna's world is very much like ours, with a few significant differences. In the second book, Master of the World, it's a Jules Verne-style world, inspired by Jules Verne, so it's very steampunky and lots of weird airships and submarines and floating islands and weapons and things like that. The most recent book, Book 3, The Moonlit World, which came out last fall in trade paperback and ebook and will be out in mass market paperback this summer, it takes place in a world that I like to describe as werewolves and vampires and peasants. Oh my! Because it was shaped by people who really liked werewolves and vampires and that sort of thing. So that one was a great deal of fun to write. The fourth book, I hope, will be out this fall. The first three books were published by Daw Books. The fourth book will come out from my own Shadowpaw Press, because I'm currently writing something entirely different for Daw Books. My next book for Daw, which is my major New York publisher, is The Tangled Stars, which is a kind of humorous space opera, which I won't say too much about yet because I'm very much in the process of writing it and it might change. But I'm looking forward to getting that done, and it'll be out in 2022. My other most recent book is called Blue Fire, written under my pseudonym E.C. Blake, and it's an epic young adult fantasy, which three young people from very different cultures within this overarching kingdom that they live in must all work together in order to save their kingdom and the people in it from destruction. So that barely explains what it's about, but you can find out more if you go to shadowpawpress.com. And the other thing that Shadowpaw Press is bringing out is Shapers of Worlds Volume 2. Now, last year, I successfully kickstarted Shapers of Worlds, which is an anthology featuring guests from the first year of this podcast. And it was very successful. It includes, because it's available now in ebook and print everywhere, it includes new stories from Tanya Huff, Shauna McGuire, David Weber, Ellie Modisett Jr., John C. Wright, DJ Butler, Christopher Rocchio, Shelley Adina, and me, and reprints from John Scalzi, Joe Haldeman, David Brin, Julie E. Cerneda, Fonda Lee, Gareth L. Powell, Dr. Charles E. Gannon, Derek Kunskin, and Thoreya Dyer. Shapers of Worlds Volume 2, which I have now successfully kickstarted. That Kickstarter ran in March, I guess, and succeeded. So I'm in the process of gathering stories and editing and all that stuff right now. It's going to be a bigger book with more original fiction. It will have brand new stories from Kelly Armstrong, Marie Brennan, Helen Dale, Candace Jane Dorsey, Lisa Foyles, Susan Forrest, James Allen Gardner, Matthew Hughes, Helly Kennedy, Lisa Kessler, Adria Laycraft, Ira Naiman, Garth Nix, Tim Pratt, Edward Savio, Brian Thomas Schmidt, Jeremy Schall, and me. And reprints from Jeffrey A. Carver, Barbara Hambly, Nancy Kress, David D. Levine, S.M. Sterling, and Carrie Vaughn. And again, as in the first anthology, that list of authors includes winners and nominees for every major science fiction and fantasy literary award, plus several international bestsellers. So I'm working on that now. It should be out this fall in ebook and print and available everywhere, so keep an eye on that. Just one other thing I want to mention before we get to the interview with Jane Yolen. I have traditionally done a full transcript on these podcasts, and I will still have a full transcript for this one, but it's going to be delayed a little bit. And I'm actually thinking I'm going to have to phase out the full transcripts. I like them, but they are an enormous amount of work, even though I use an automated transcription service. And I don't see from my website statistics that a lot of people are spending a lot of time reading those transcripts. So I think I'm going to back off on the transcripts and focus on getting the recordings out by themselves, and then perhaps adding transcripts later on as I have time. So just something that might change if you're used to seeing a full transcript with every episode. I think in order to keep the podcast going, and because I have so many other demands on my time, I may back off from that, but it won't change the interviews themselves. I hope they're still entertaining and informative, as I'm sure this one will be. And one more thing before I start the interview with Jane Yolen. The World Shapers podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. All right, let's get on to this episode's guest, Jane Yolen. Jane Yolen is the author of some 400 books for children and adults. Her stories and poems have won, deep breath, the Caldecott Medal, 2 Nebula Awards, 2 Christopher Medals, 3 World Fantasy Awards, 3 Mythopoeic Fantasy Awards, 2 Golden Kite Awards, the Jewish Book Award, and the Massachusetts Center for the Book Award. She's also won the World Fantasy Association's Lifetime Achievement Award, the Science Fiction Writers of America's Grand Master Award, and the Science Fiction Poetry Association's Grand Master Award, which together she calls the Trifecta. Plus, she has won both the Association of Jewish Libraries Award and the Catholic Libraries Award, a medal. Also the DeGrammond Medal and the Kurlan Award and the Ann Izzard Storytelling Award at least 3 times. 6 colleges and universities have given her honorary doctorates for her body of work. So as she says, you could call her Dr. Yolen, even though she can't set a leg. She lives in Massachusetts much of the year and in Scotland the rest of the year. And Jane, welcome to the World Shapers.
Well, thank you very much. It's always interesting to hear your life done in short form like that. And even when I write it myself, I'm always a little behind the times.
I always like to see if I can find a connection. We have not met in person, but back when you had Jane Yolen books, you did reject me once. So there's that.
You're good company then.
Well, actually, it was a very nice rejection because you said that there was nothing wrong with the book. It was a fantasy called The Dark Unicorn, and that a larger house might very well be able to take it on. It just didn't suit your house, which, you know, was a lot better than, you know, just getting the form rejection back. So I appreciated it at the time. And the book did eventually find a not very good home, but I'm going to be revising it and bringing out again with my own little publishing company before too long. So, and it did get nominated for an award. So all of that, it was very nice to get that sort of personal response from you back then.
I don't want to make you nervous or anything, but I still get rejections, and I love my rejections because one, they mean somebody's read it, then I can move on. But the other thing is the rejections recently say things like, "This is lyrical, lovely writing. I love the characters. It's not for us."
Well, I've had my share of rejections now after all the years I've been writing. And you have 400 books. I only have 60 or so, so I'm well behind you, but still. So we're going to start with what I usually say is taking you back into the mists of time. Just to find out about your, you know, your growing up and how you got interested in writing. Most of us started as readers and then became writers. And how did that all play out for you? So tell me about yourself, Jane.
Well, there's a lot to tell because I'm 82 years old. We might be on this for 72 years. I grew up in a family, a Jewish family in New York. There were books everywhere. The parents made no distinction between what books we could and we couldn't read. If we were interested in it and we could get through it, we could read it, which meant that I was reading stuff so far over my head when I was 4 years old. But I loved the sound of the language. And I think that stayed with me all of my life. My father was a journalist who had become, by the time I came along, had become a head of the Overseas Press Club. But he then left journalism itself and became first a promotion person, and then became a vice president at Hill and Knowlton, which was public relations. And he was the one who was involved with getting people into newspapers, magazines, and books. So there were always books there. And he actually wrote, I'm going to use quotes around the term wrote because he had got other people to write for him, six books or seven books under his name. He never wrote any of them. I wrote the first one. That was actually my first book, but I don't count it because my name isn't on it. And my brother became a journalist. My mother wrote short stories, but only sold one in her life. But she also made and sold crossword puzzles and double cross sticks. And all their friends were known and very well-known writers. They ranged from the very known ones like Hemingway and James Thurber to people you and I still don't know today. But it meant that as I was growing up, I thought that all grown-ups were writers. I knew there were teachers, librarians, butchers, bakers, candlestick makers, the cop on the beat. I mean, we lived in New York City. I saw all of this. I thought that was their day job. And at night, they all went home to write. So in my little pea brain at that moment came the idea that whatever I did during the day, I would be a writer because I'd go home at night and write. And that's it sounds metaphoric, but it's absolutely true.
It's interesting because I talk to so many writers who say, oh, when I was growing up, I never knew a writer. I didn't know people could be writers. And then they found out they could be a writer. And yours was quite the opposite, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And if you, I bet if you talk to my brother who lives in Brazil, who is a newspaper man for all of his life, he'd say pretty much the same thing.
So when did you, I assume you started writing then as a child?
I wrote as a child. I mean, I was the writer in my elementary school. I wrote class plays that we all played in. I wrote poems. I wrote little lyrics to songs. And the same thing happened once I got into high school. I was the one who, was known as the writer. And in college, it was the same. I wrote a lot of songs, a lot of short stories, but mostly poetry.
Were there books that particularly influenced you during those early years?
Well, I was a huge King Arthur fan, so I read everything anybody ever wrote about King Arthur. So, yes, along the way, I've written three or four King Arthur books myself. But I love folk and fairy tales, and Hans Christian Andersen, Oscar Wilde, absolutely fascinated me. And the poets, it was poetry that stuck with me all through my life. I'm still writing poetry to this day.
What was it that drew you to poetry?
I think because I was very musical to begin with. So I started with lyrics. And we're talking George Gershwin here, right? But then when as I grew up and people like Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen were writing the kind of music I like, but the kind of also lyrics that I like that were really poems set to music, that kind of calcified it for me.
It's interesting. I have committed poetry. I don't know if it's good poetry or not, but they are very different writing disciplines, writing prose and poetry. Do you find that writing the poetry informs your prose, the way that you write prose?
I write very lyrical prose, but I tell you, I know when a picture book or a novel or a short story of mine is good. I don't know, for the most part, if a poem is good or good enough. I'm always surprised when people take my poems for journals, magazines, anthologies. Half the time, it's not the poems I would have taken. I'll send them, say, I send them seven, they take two or three. Those are not the three I would have taken. So I'm not sure why I don't know which one of my poems are the best. When I can tell right away if a book works or a story works.
Once you were, well, your first book was published when you were what, 20, the first official one was published when you were 22, is that right?
Yeah.
So you were still in university or just out of university?
No, I was out 2 years. I graduated in 60. So I was out 3 years. I graduated in 60, but I've had poetry published all the way through and newspaper stuff and magazine articles published. But my first book, I sold it on my 22nd birthday.
Nice birthday present.
Absolutely. I ran. After I sold it, I ran 2 blocks to the Overseas Press Club where my father was holding court at lunchtime, and I said, "Daddy, Daddy, I sold my first book." And he looked at me, and then he looked at all the guys. There weren't any women, I think, in the press club at that time. And he said, "Fellas, drinks are on the house, and I'll talk for my little girl."
You started doing a lot of editorial work then in the 60s, did you not?
Yeah, I first worked for Knox Berger before he became an agent. He was an editor at one of the paperback reprint publishers. And I worked for him for about a year. And then when I sold my first book and it was a children's book, I thought maybe I'd better learn more about children's books. So I did two things. I took a course in writing for children at the New School, but I at the same time gave my name to a headhunter and said, "I don't care who it is, but I want you to find me a job in children's book publishing in New York City," because I was living in New York City at that point. They found me a job with a packager who did children's books, which was interesting because then I got to write a lot of stuff within the books that they were doing. My name never got on them, but I got to do that. So there were a couple of poems and crossword puzzles and fiddly bits in books that, I mean, they're long gone. This was 1961, 62, that I wrote. That will never, no one except me, and probably not even me anymore, know that I had done.
It's a bit like the backup singers on some recordings of, like, I think of the Jersey Boys, where they're doing backup vocals for other singers that nobody's remembers anymore. But meanwhile, it's the Four Seasons singing the backup songs back there.
So that's how I got started, and then one of my fellow editors at the Packager was an older woman, and she was a friend of mine, and we had to show the Packager anything we wrote first, because they had first dibs on it. But if the editor rejected it was okay, and we could take it elsewhere. And her name was Frances Keane. We all called her Keen. And she said to me one time, she said, I showed her a manuscript called The Witch Who Wasn't. And she said, "I'm going to tell you a secret." She said, "I like this very much, but I don't want to publish it here. I'm about to take a job as head of Macmillan's Children's Publishing. Will you bring it to me there?" I said, "You got it." Almost maybe my second or third book that was published. And Keane and I remained friends until her death, which was rather too soon. But she was very important in my early writing days.
You mentioned that you had taken a course in writing children's literature at the New School. And I always ask authors who have taken formal writing courses how helpful they were to their career, because I get a variety of answers to that question.
Well, one of the picture books that I tried there, I sold.
Oh, well, there you go.
So yeah, I guess it worked. Things are so different now that the kind of book that I learned about and that I wrote then, I would not be able to write and sell now. But I learned to be aware of how these things change. And that's important. I think one of the reasons I've been so successful for so many years, whereas other people have sort of dropped by the wayside, who had started about the same time as I did, is that I'm very flexible and I'm able to do any number of things. And if the picture book world changes, I change with it. If the novel world changes, I change with it. If I can't get a big publisher to publish something, I get a wonderful small publisher like Tachyon to publish a book of mine. So I'm infinitely flexible, and I love meeting new editors and talking ideas with them. Because having been an editor, I was an editor for 15 years. Having been an editor, I know how to talk to editors. I know they're the friends, not the enemies. Nobody buys a book to make it bad.
Yeah, there are authors, especially new authors, who are kind of scared of editors and think somehow they're going to take their deathless prose and ruin it somehow. And that's just not the experience you have with a professional editor. They want a good book too. So your experience as an editor, how has you're writing and editing at the same time? How do those two things work together? Do you find that by looking at other people's work, it makes your own work stronger? You're able to see how other people are dealing with, the same, we all encounter the same problems in our writing that we have to solve, characterization and all that stuff. Did you find that being an editor helped you as a writer?
That's exactly it, but that's the second thing I learned. The first thing I learned looking at other people's writing was, gee, I'm a good writer. Because a lot of bad stuff comes over the desk. Anyone who is an editor will tell you that 85 to 90% of the stuff that they see is so amateurish, there's nothing they can do about it. It's the other 10 to 15% that there are possibilities, and more than half of those are not the kind of book that they're looking for. When I was an editor and doing editing fantasy and science fiction for young middle grade and young adults, I would get coming over my desk nonfiction books, cookbooks, mystery novels, picture books, none of which was of interest to me, but I still had to send a letter back with it. So the first thing that anyone who's a writer, I say, look at where you're sending it. Make sure it's the sort of thing they're looking for. If you don't know what they're looking for, find out. You can ask other authors. You can join groups like Science Fiction Writers of America or this Society of Children's Book Writers and find out information. The more you have information about what a particular editor or a particular publisher is looking for, the easier you're going to make your life.
I suspect the problem of inappropriate material flooding editors' offices is even worse now with email being a way to submit. It's just become much easier for for those places that take email submissions. The volume must be enormous.
It's not that we'll take email admissions. It's who say we're open to anyone. Open to anyone. You should see who anyone is. They are people who have never finished something. They've started it but finished it. They've written a book that's just like their favorite book, or they've taken characters from their favorite book and used them, which is a no-no, unless the author is long dead or has given them permission. So there are those sorts of things that that you get over and over and over again.
Now, your own writing, you've won a lot of awards. How did that all ramp up? I mean, you start out like anybody else, you're selling a few books, and then you've built and built. So, were you really gratified by the response your writing has had over the years?
Well, of course, I'm gratified. Some of the awards that I've won, I go, huh? Some of the awards that I've won, I go, oh my God, I am so honored. Some of them I've said, I think they missed the mark on this one. And some of them I say thank you and put the thing up in the attic. Because honestly, there are more awards out there than there are writers. And they happen year after year after year after year. The ones that I am especially proud of, those are ones that I keep where people can see them. But at this point, I must have, like 200, 300 awards, certificates, that sort of thing. And occasionally they spell my name wrong on it. Occasionally, it's for a book that I think of my work is minor. But the ones that are really special to me, those are the ones that I take out and look at.
Which one set fire to your coat?
Well, it was the Skylight Award given by the Boston Science Fiction Convention, not for any particular work. It's for somebody who has been doing good work in within the community, the science fiction community. And I always volunteered for things at BosCon, which is the science fiction convention. So they gave that to me. And I took it home, as I did with any award I would get or any certificate. It would sit on my kitchen table, for about a week, and then it would sort of slowly move upstairs to the attic. Now, the attic is not just an attic; it is where I store awards, where I have all my extra copies of foreign editions. Where I have all my files. So it's a library, and it's my entire folklore library is up there too. So it's a little bit like a library slash boasting place. But this award, the Skylark Award, was sitting there. Had been a raw, rainy, dark New England winter. And it was sitting in front of the kitchen window, which is a huge, large window. It was a wooden plinth with a micro, not a microscope. What is it called?
Magnifying glass.
Magnifying glass up top, large magnifying glass up top, because it was named after the Lensman series.
Right.
And my husband and I were coming down the stairs to go actually to Smith College, where I was winning a Smith medal. I was a Smith graduate, and I said, "I smell something funny." We ran into the kitchen, and there was my good coat was smoking because it was a beautiful blue sky day with the sun coming in from the east, pouring in through the lens and setting on fire. I mean, if we had gone earlier, or if we had gone later, the house might have gone up. So I called up my friend Bruce Coville, who had been the one to hand me the award, and I told him what happened. And I said, "Bruce, I'm going to have to put this award where the sun don't shine." Dead silence on the other end. And Bruce is a huge laugher. Dead silence. And I went, "I didn't say that," and I hung up. So then he told the committee what had happened. The committee said, they gave the next one, "Will I come and say that as a warning?" And so that's become something that every year at BosCon, when they're giving out the award, I have to run up and say, "Stop, stop, stop, before you take that award, I need to give you this warning." And so it's become, it's fandom at its best, I think.
The Canadian Science Fiction Fantasy Award, the Aurora Award. The current one is just a plexiglass aurora, but the original one was this piece made out of laser cut metal that you could disassemble and put into your suitcase if you were flying after winning one of them. And apparently, the trick with that one was because of all these sharp edges, people discovered that if they didn't wrap it very carefully in their suitcase, it shredded their clothes on the way back. So I have one, but I didn't have that problem.
Oh, Ed, I love that story. I never heard that one.
The other thing about it is it's very pointy metal in a vase. And when I won mine, it was in Montreal, and I got on it and I discovered that if you pointed at the pointy side out, it gave you more room on the elevator because nobody wanted to get close to it.
Tales of fandom.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about your upcoming book, Touch of Bone, Arch of Bone, sorry. And we're going to use that as an example of your general overall writing process. You can talk about any books you want during this process, but then you've written also for adults and middle grade and young adults. And I want to maybe get your thoughts on the differences among those three. But maybe first of all, just tell us a little bit about Arch of Bone.
Well, there are stories that are in your heart. And wherever they started, they're in your heart. And you want to tell them if you're a writer. And this was one I carried for a long time. It takes place in 1864 in Nantucket. And it's really tagging on to the end of one of my all-time favorite novels, which was Moby Dick. And I was, there I am, a New York City Jewish kid, loving Moby Dick from the first time I read it, and would read it as I grew up every 10 years, because it's a big book, it takes a long time to read. And anytime I was talking to an editor, it was going to be historical, but it was going to have fantastical elements in it. Anytime I talked to an editor, they looked at me shell-shocked, you know, like that doesn't sound like something I want to do. So I put it aside and I put it aside and I put it aside for years. And then I started publishing with Tachyon. And Tachyon said, we're starting a middle grade young adult line now. And we'd love it if you would have something for us to see. And I talked to them about this book because it's a book that starts out. I knew how it was starting out and I knew where it was going. But there was a major problem. And I'll tell you that in a minute. I knew it started out with a young boy, 13, 14 year old boy, whose mother has been sick with whatever for the whole winter. His father is on a whaling ship. So he's away. So the boy is kind of man of the house. His father's been gone for about a year or so. And it's early spring. There's a knock on the door and he opens the door and there's this man he's never seen before. And, you know, normally you would know your neighbors in Nantucket. And he says, who are you? And the man says, call me Ishmael. Mm. So it's Ishmael coming to tell Starbucks wife and son that the Starbuck was the first mate on Moby Dick, that everybody died except for himself. And so that's how I knew it was going to start. And I also knew that the boy being upset about the man staying at their house and thinking that his mother has gone through widowhood, you know, in a day, and now she's looking at a new man, which is not true. He takes off on his own little cat boat with his dog and into the teeth of a nor'easter. And that's all I knew.
A great beginning.
Yeah, I knew he was going to break up on an island. So it was going to be Moby Dick meets Robinson Crusoe with some miraculous dreams or oracular dreams. That's all I knew. But the thing that stopped me over and over again, just going ahead and writing it and then trying to, you know, peddle it, was that you needed a good knowledge of sailing. I had none. A good knowledge of, I mean, I lived in Massachusetts, but I lived in Western Massachusetts. I could go and I could have somebody sail me around to some of the places, but I didn't have the deep knowledge of it. Fast forward almost 60 years. And I'm working with Tachyon. They ask for it. And I'm thinking about it and thinking, you know, I'm in my 80s. If I don't write this book, it's never going to get written. But I still am worried about this. And my husband had died 14 years earlier. So I've been a widow all that time. And I re-meet a guy that I had dated in college. And we fell in love. We're married. We're living together. We have children, grandchildren. He is a sailor, had his own boat. He would sail, he and his wife, he and his kids, they would sail on this boat all around the Nantucket area because he lives in Mystic, Connecticut. And I said, would you read this book? Well, he'd been a teacher all his life. And one of his favorite books he loved to teach was, guess what?
Moby Dick.
Yes. It was, you know, the right time. And he read it. He showed me charts of the waters. He told me when I had a boat thing wrong, you know, they don't say that, they call it this. He read it very thoroughly for me. I couldn't have done it without him. Or I wouldn't have done it without him. So sometimes a book has to sit. Sometimes a book has to mature. And sometimes the author has to mature. And sometimes luck has to come into it.
So what did your, I mean, you talked, the idea obviously had been floating around for a very long time, and then you were finally able to do something with it. Once you settled down to write it, and in your other books as well, what does your sort of planning, outlining process look like? And I presume it might be different for an adult book or a middle grade book, and certainly for a picture book, but what does that look like for you?
You think I outline, do you? Oh,
well, that's the question.
Rarely. When I first started writing novels, I did. And then I discovered that they boxed me in. Because no matter what I put on the page as where I was going, as I got into the book, things happened that I wasn't expecting and weren't on my outline. I'm more like what they call a pantser, flying by the seat of my pants. I like to think of it as flying into the mist. I know where the book is going. I have to get to know who the characters are. And sometimes the characters say to you, I'm not going there. That's
more like, sailing into the mist on this book, I guess, instead of flying.
Exactly. I didn't know that he was going to have to rebuild a boat. I didn't know he was going to have these oracular dreams. Once Tachyon said they wanted it, I knew that I had to have a fantasy element. That had never been in it to begin with. So what did I do? He finds an arch of bone, which is a whalebone's jaw. And when he leans against it, he has dreams. The first dream is of a whale telling him about how the whales have been dying and why and how things are changing. And then the next three dreams are about the boat that his father died on. So I reread Moby Dick, annotated it, and talked to Peter about it over and over again. And I think that if you, for me, some people really need to fill out, you know, everything about their world and everything about where they're going and know everything bit by bit. That's not how I work. Now, having said that, I just finished another novel, a middle grade fantasy novel called Sea Dragon of Fife. And it's about the, it's part of a series that's going to be called, we're still fiddling with this, The Royal and Ancient Monster Hunters. So it's RNA, Monster Hunters. And in that, because I first outlined it years ago when I still thought I could outline, and it turns out that stuff that I put in later changed the ending, made the ending more poignant. Because as I was going along and writing it, I realized these are some kids who are out there as monster hunters. They're school kids. And the head of the group is the schoolmaster. And we're talking 1900s Scotland. And they're in danger, but they're out there to kill the sea dragon. The sea dragon is female. They've ki already killed one of her sons, may have killed the second one. And then they finally come upon her. And everybody thinks that's fine. And I'm going, wait a minute, wait a minute. They're killing a mom. You have to say something about this. And that changed the dynamics when I have the main character who's telling this story saying that she feels bad about this, so she has some real criticism. Meanwhile, it's a dragon that's tried to eat two boys and may have killed other people. So it's a dragon doing what a dragon does to feed its family. So that was not in the original outline, and it changed things very much.
So, what does your actual writing process itself look like then? You're sort of not referring to your outline all the time, and then and writing things. Do you? I always ask this. Do you, write longhand under a tree with parchment and a quill pen, or do you work set hours during the day? You work in your home. Do you go out? Well, not now, but have you sometimes gone out to other places to write, or how does that all work for you?
I have a fairly simple thing. I get up in the morning, I go into my writing room, still in my jammies, and start to write. I write for about an hour. It may just at that beginning, just looking at my email, playing a little bit of Boggle, writing a new poem, because I send out a poem a day to subscribers. And then I go downstairs. Have something to eat, go back upstairs and get dressed for work as if I were going out to an office. The office is in my right there in my house. And then it's button chair time. I teach my students all about BIC, butt in chair. If you're not there working and you're looking for an idea, and the muse comes by, she'll give it to you. But if you're not in your chair, she's heading out, out west to give it to someone else. And I probably work between 4 and 8 hours a day. Some of that is just reading. Some of that is writing. Some of that is revising. Some of that is sending stuff out. But I'm at my desk. You don't write 400 books if you don't sit at your desk. And it's been an adventure. I mean, it's not that I don't go out and do things. I have a house in Scotland that I go to, and I'll write there as well. Peter and I are right now sitting in his house in Mystic, Connecticut. I was writing this morning. And I do other things. I'm a very personable kind of person. I like to see friends and take walks with them and talk business with them, or if they're not in the children's book field, or the children's book world, or just the writing world, I have many friends, a huge number of friends who are artists. I'd love to go into their studios and see what they're doing. So it's this, but I'm always a good part of my day writing, unless I'm at a conference when I'm probably not. And interestingly, the stuff that I do when I'm in my jammies feels like fiddling, but when I'm dressed for work, I mean, looking like I've gone out in my business clothes, that's when I do my best work.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, everybody approaches it differently. That's one of the interesting things about this podcast is getting the different approaches that people take. Are you would you consider yourself a fast writer or a slow writer or somewhere in the middle, or how do you typify yourself?
Well, you have to say fast given how many books I have out, but each book is different. Some books practically write themselves, and other books you're banging your head on the wall. So, but I am a very fast rewriter. If somebody takes the book and it needs some work still, that's where I put all my energy until it's done.
Well, that's the next thing I was going to ask you about was the rewriting process. So
Yeah.
do you end up with a complete first draft? You go back to the beginning and revise before you submit? Do you use beta readers are all the thing right now? I never had them, but lots of authors talk about that. And you did mention that your husband had read your book to help you with the sailing and so forth. How does all that work for you?
Well, I, first of all, because even if it's an adult book, I read it out loud. That comes from all of my work in children's books. I always read stuff out loud. And that makes me hear things that I have a little sign near my desk that says, the eye and the ear are different listeners. You can, if you are reading your own manuscript, you can elide if you're not reading it out loud, so that you miss stuff, you miss the bad stuff. And if you are reading it out loud, then you are going to hear everything that doesn't work. I'm a good reader, so I can sometimes almost even convince myself that a line works when it doesn't. But I'm a line by line reader, out loud. Then I go back and I will, with a picture book, I might revise it five, six, eight, 10 times before I ever send it out. With a novel, I probably do two really solid revisions before I ever send it out, the longer piece. And that includes, I have actually beta readers. Peter is one. My daughter, Heidi Stemple, is another one. And then I have other readers. When I'm in Scotland, my friend Debbie Harris reads for me. Because I think that as much as I know about writing and as much as I know about editing, there's nothing like a new eye to look at it and say, I didn't get this. The connection was in my head, but I never got it down on paper. So I really like having those beta readers. Every time, though, I choose somebody who has written something, who has published something, I think that they're willing to be fierce. And I need a fierce reader.
Yes, if you give it to your, in my case, say my mom or somebody, and they said, "Well, that's really nice. That's not helpful." You want people to say, "No, I didn't understand what was going on in page 37 and why your character did that stupid thing and all that kind of stuff." The criticism is actually much more helpful than just praise.
That's why I choose writers. All my children are writers, published writers. My friend Debbie is a well-published fantasy writer, living in Scotland. So there's that professionalism that says I'm not going to just say nice things about you. My kids send me stuff for me to read that they've done, and I'm very honest with them. From the beginning, when they first started reading, and they would leave little things for me to read on the mantelpiece, and I would say to them, do you want the mommy answer or do you want the editor answer? And they would say, oh, we want the editor answer. This was before they were published. I'd say, all right, first I'm going to give you the mommy answer. Mommy answer is, this is wonderful. Oh, you are such a good writer. Now, here's the real truth from the editor. It's very good. It still needs work. So I'm not, since I was always honest with them, they are very honest with me.
When your work does get to an editor, are you still getting this is very good, but it needs work from editors, even at this point in your career?
This is what I'm getting a lot from editors. They will say to my agent, if I haven't worked with them before, they will say to my agent, is Jane willing to work on this? And I think to myself, they think there's a person who has done as many books as I have would not work with the editor, would not be revising. It sort of makes me sort of stunned as to who have they been working with. Of course, I'll revise. I just recently revised something that an editor liked but felt had some problems with. And I sat down and thought about what she said for about a week and a half. And then I said, she's absolutely right. Then I rewrote it. And it's much better. Will she take it? I have no idea, but it's much better. And so somebody will take it.
Yeah, my editor, my main editor is Sheila Gilbert at Daw Books, and she's wonderful for for pointing out those things that, yeah, I can make that better. You're absolutely right, and editors do that for you. It's really quite wonderful to have an editor. I wanted to ask you about the differences between writing for middle grade, young adult, and adult. Are those just, to a certain extent, they're kind of just marketing categories, I guess, but there are, do you feel there are distinct differences among those three beyond just the age of the characters?
I think that in some ways they sort of glide into one another. It's true. And if you realize that the term young adult had not even been invented until the early 1960s, when somebody figured out that, oh, we can get an extra sale out of this if we, put it in the into that category, as well as perhaps also selling it as an adult book. And many books are considered young adult, adult as crossover books. In fact, I think there's now an actual crossover designation. But that
New
just.
adult, they sometimes call new adult. Is that the term?
New adult, exactly. That's the term. So the problem is in the not in the book itself, but in the age of the main character. If you have a main character who is 15, 16, it'll be nicely read by the younger ones and the young adults. But if the character is 12, 13, then a lot of young adults will not look at it. Adults will, but young adults go, I'm more interested in kids my age. So a lot of times you sort of weasel out of it. You either don't say how old they are, or you put them in exciting enough places that anyone will want to read the book. I was, as I said early on, I was as a child reading books that were way over my head. And kids who read at a very young age will do that. But a lot of young adult readers are really very happy just reading about themselves. I think the middle grade who is still trying to figure out what it is they would like to read, how far up they'd like to read, are the ones who are more flexible. And I think the adults are the most flexible at all because we'll still read about kids. We'll still read about Alice in Wonderland. We'll still read about Huck Finn and they're not our age anymore. But we will also read about older people. The problem is in the packaging, because I did a book a few years ago with, I God, I'm losing her name now, Midori Snyder, who we wrote a book called Except the Queen, and the two main characters were middle-aged. They were old fairies who have been kicked out of fairy for spying on the queen. And so they no longer have the magic that keeps them young. So now they are on the high side of middle-aged. And there are two younger characters in it. They're not the main characters, but guess who is on the cover? Not the main characters, the young woman. Who is one of the minor characters there. And when we complained, they said, this is the best cover for it. Nobody's going to buy a book with two elderly women cavorting around. So that's the problem, not the readership, but how they market the book.
Do you have a preference out of all the various age levels you've written for, or do you love writing in all these various niches equally?
My sweet spot is short, meaning poetry, picture books, short stories, or a short novel. But I have written a number of longer novels, which I'm very proud of. And it's just that they go on and on and on and on for 4 or 5 years That's when I get tired of them, even if I'm doing my best work. So I think I have a very short attention span and a very short boredom span.
Well, we're getting within the last 10 minutes or so here, so I want to ask my big philosophical questions.
All right.
There's three. The first one is, why do you write? The second one is, why do you think anybody writes? As human beings, why do we write? And then the third one is, why write stories with fantastical elements in them? So let's start with the beginning. Why do you write?
Because I can't not. Because I have stories in my head all the time. I go to bed, I dream stories, I wake up, I remember parts of those stories. Sometimes I can use the parts, sometimes I can't, which is frustrating. But I am never without ideas for books. In fact, I give ideas away to other people.
I get that one a lot, actually, from writers who will say, I can't not write. And it's almost a compulsion. I think there's very much an innate writer. I don't know if it's a gene. I guess it's related, some sort of genetic component to people who become, at least become writers who are published and read and write at that kind of level. I'm reading to my wife, I'm reading Robertson Davies' collection of posthumous essays. I always forget the name of it. The Merry Heart, it's called. And he writes quite a bit about this topic and about being a writer and just writers being almost born as opposed to made. Anyway, so why do you think a lot of us write? Why do you think human beings write? Why do we tell these stories and put them down on words and share them with other people?
Partially because it gives pleasure, partially because it gives information, partially because it gives a new way of looking at something, but partially because human beings are, more than anything else, good liars. We make ourselves look better, we make our children look better. We tell stories about our family that make us look great. We boast about things. It's a human failing that's been turned into a human success, I think. We laugh in our family and say all Yolands, all of the Yolands we know are good casual liars. They tell stories. They are funny. They make up stuff, but only our side of the family and one or two others, sort of outliers, became passionate storytellers. My great grandfather, I think it was, had an inn in the Ukraine, and he loved not the work of being an innkeeper. That he left to the wife and kids and the hirelings. He would sit by the fire and tell stories. And he used to tell stories that he knew came from somewhere else, but he passed them off as his own. So he told a Yiddish version of Romeo and Juliet, which was his big piece. Now, I don't think he ever told anyone that Shakespeare had written the story.
Well, Shakespeare probably got it from somewhere else, knowing Shakespeare.
Exactly. We're passing wonderful lies on.
When I was a kid, there's a famous Canadian writer named W.O. Mitchell who actually spent part of his childhood in the town that I grew up in, Saskatchewan. And he had a there was a TV show on CBC, which were, I guess they were his stories, or I don't know, he hosted it anyway, dramatized stories. And the name of it was The Magic Lie. That's what he liked to call writing, the magic lie. And
Yep,
then
that works for me.
the third part of the question, you have, of course, written stuff that doesn't have a fantastical element, but you have also written a lot that does. So why include things that are completely fantastical into these stories that we like to tell?
Think people, because people have been doing that forever. They've told folk tales and fairy tales and tales of magic and wonder. we all know we're going to die. So we make up these wonderful stories of what happens after, before, during. We all hope that we will have wonderful weddings and marriages to a prince, probably, you know, a king, possibly. We want to change lives with our stories. I think those of us who write for children have a better chance of that than anyone. Once in a while, you'll get a book that, you know, like Silent Spring, that will change a great many lives. But normally, adult books don't change lives the way children's book change lives, because we're taking someone who has not yet fully been reconstructed themselves, and the stories that we tell help them think in different ways, shape them. I'm very aware of that. I mean, I get letters from children all the time, and I meet grown-ups who say to me, their grandparents, you know, they say to me, I read your stories all the time to my grandchildren because they were the stories I grew up on. But that makes me feel really old when they say that. But it's true. Those are the stories that we carry with us into adulthood. And they have, for whatever reason, shaped our lives.
Certainly the ones I've read have shaped mine, that's for sure. I still remember the ones, you know, the stories I read as a kid are the ones that really stick with me far more than what I've read since as an adult. Mm-hmm. So we're just about out of time. So let's find out, what are you working on now?
Well, The Sea Dragon of Fife, which is a short novel. I have a book of poems about the Jewish experience and the Shoah coming out, called Kaddish. That's for adults. I've written two books with one of my granddaughters that are being published. Hmm. One I wrote with her when she's 10. She's now in law school. And the other we wrote after she said, oh, I'm so excited about selling this book, but you know, I'm really going to be a lawyer. And the next morning she had the start of a manuscript on my desk. So I said, yeah, right. Okay. I said, stick to your day job, but you can write when, you know, in the in-betweens. So the one that's coming out that she wrote with me when she was 10, which we have done significant rewriting since, I have to tell you, is called Nana Dances. And it's a picture book. So it's full of pictures, and it's all about various nanas who dance with their children and boys, girls, different people of different shapes and sizes and colors. And it's I think it's just a very sweet and lovely book. I have a bunch of easy reader books coming out, two of which are based on the interrupting cow joke that one of my granddaughters used to tell me every time I would visit. Do you know that joke?
No.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Interrupting cow.
Interrupting cow who?
Did you hear me moo? I mooed you in the middle of your asking. So this is a cow that nobody in the stable likes because she's always telling that horrible joke. And she ends up with a variety of outsiders who love what she does. And so everybody lives happily ever after. I'm on the fourth book now.
So, and there's more?
Oh, yes. There's many, many more. I've sold a book called Bird Boy, which is being illustrated. And it's a kind of semi-sequel to Al Moon, which I wrote, which won the Caldecott. Let's see, what else have I sold? I'd have to get out my list. I've sold about maybe 15, 18 more books. I have about 20 manuscripts out there. I have about, in total, 130 unsold manuscripts that are rotating around there. And I'm always writing something new.
Oh, and people tell me I'm prolific, and now I'm realizing that I'm not. So well, that's very impressive, and it's been great joy to talk to you. I guess your website is the best place online if people are looking to find out more about you.
It's certainly the most accurate because my son Adam, who is my webmaster, and I work on it on a regular basis. If you go anywhere else, you will find that I have written over 100 books. You will sometimes find that I'm married to Adam, who is my son. I don't trust anything other than an author's own website because we know most about ourselves. We know what's current, what's not current.
And it's just janeyolen.com.
That's right.
Okay, well, thanks so much for doing this, Jane. I really appreciated talking to you. I certainly enjoyed it. I hope you did too.
I did a whole lot. Thank you.
And best of luck with every single one of your many projects that's coming up.
You too. Bye.
Bye. And thanks again to Jane Yolen for that wonderful interview. I really enjoyed talking to Jane, and I hope you enjoyed listening to us chat. That brings us to the end of another episode of the World Shapers podcast. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. In the meantime, you can find the World Shapers online at theworldshapers.com, where you will find all of the past episodes available for download and transcripts, as I mentioned off the top, but most of them, those may be fading away, the full transcripts. It's just been an awful lot of work, but they are there for many of these episodes. You can also find The World Shapers on Twitter at The World Shapers. You can find it on Facebook at The World Shapers. You can find me at edwardwillett.com, two T's on Willett. You can find my online store where you can buy autographed books at edwardwillettshop.com. And you can find Shadow Paw Press, which publishes some of my books and has published the Shapers of Worlds anthology and will be publishing the upcoming Shapers of Worlds Volume 2 anthology at shadowpawpress.com. You can also find me on Twitter at eWillett and Shadow Paw Press at Shadow Paw Press. You can find me on Facebook at edward.willett and Shadow Paw Press at Shadow Paw Press. You can find me on Instagram at Edward Willett Author, and you won't find Shadow Paw Press there. And of course, you can also find me on LinkedIn and various other places. I'm on quite a few different sites, but those are the main ones. If you're curious and want to keep up with what's going on with my writing or with the World Shapers podcast, I think that does it. So once again, thanks for listening to the World Shapers. Come back for many future episodes. And again, visit theworldshapers.com if you'd like to check out some of the past episodes you might have missed. That's it for this time. I'll be back in 2 weeks with an interview with another author of science fiction and fantasy as we talk about the process of bringing to life new worlds and new civilizations to boldly write what no one has written before. That's it for the World Shapers this time. Bye for now.